Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Health studies have long lacked diversity. Problems that may plague the Black or Latino population aren't necessarily reflected in decades-long research projects. There is change in the air. More recent studies have focused specifically on the heart health of minorities. One population, though, tends to get left out of most studies: Native Americans. American Indians have had to struggle through centuries of colonization and oppression. They were banished from the lands that nourished them and are now considered one of the unhealthiest populations on the planet. Indigenous populations have some of the highest rates of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease among people of various ethnicities. An outlier in health studies focused on Native peoples is the Strong Heart Study of American Indians. It began over 30 years ago by researchers at the National Institutes of Health. The Texas Biomedical Research Institute in San Antonio recently received a $3 million grant to continue its work on the Strong Heart Study. Shelley Cole is an associate professor and co-lead of the Population Health Program at Texas Biomed. She chairs the Strong Heart Study Steering Committee and directs the Strong Heart Study Genetic Center. She says when the program started in 1988, it was believed there was a low prevalence of heart disease among Native Americans, contrary to what Indian health providers saw in their community. The NIH National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute investigated.
So in 1988, I think people felt generally that the prevalence of heart disease was low in American Indians, but there were Indian health service doctors and others in the community who thought that just wasn't true. It didn't really jive with what they were seeing in the community. So they got involved with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of NIH, and they decided to actually have a study to identify the prevalence and risk factors for heart disease in American Indians. So they began the study in 1988 in three different regions in the U.S. to capture three different American Indian groups, one in the Northern Plains in North and South Dakota, another center in Oklahoma, and another center in Arizona. And what they found, of course, is what we know today, that heart disease occurs at really high rates in American Indians.
Is this, I think we can maybe even think back to the fact that this is a people who were displaced from their lands, manifest destiny, colonization. And so therefore, they are taken off the lands that they've lived off of for centuries. And they were moved onto reservations. They were thrown off of their land. So that connection that they had to the land and to the diet that their bodies had been accumulated to for centuries had to have had almost an immediate impact on their biology. What is it that maybe the study has found as a result of that? Is that the reason why heart disease is so prevalent among Native American populations, because of that sudden cultural 180?
That's really an interesting question, because there are many aspects to that. First, there's the psychological aspect and the cultural aspect, and having your culture disrupted, families disrupted in many cases. There's also the economic aspect. Many times, tribes were displaced to land that didn't have some of the natural resources that they once had. But there are also other issues as well. Just like any other population in the U.S., we've all been exposed to the Western diet. And so maybe because of their socioeconomic condition and other reasons, that has affected tribes more. But I would say we have to be really careful, because heart disease, type 2 diabetes, issues that are, health problems that are prevalent in American Indian communities, they're what we call complex diseases. So they do have a complex origin, both genetically and environmentally. And so it's a difficult problem. It's a complicated problem. And we're trying to really get some idea about how much those various factors interplay with each other and interact with each other.
So the study, again, it started in 1988, and I'm assuming in these last 30 years it's gone through various phases. So in the first phase, what was the study trying to determine, and sort of how has that evolved throughout the years? How have each of the phases sort of influenced future ones?
So We now know that type 2 diabetes is the biggest risk factor for heart disease in American Indian communities, just like in other communities around the world. And since that time, genetics became a part of the study. So in 1998, a family study was established to try to identify some of the genetic risk factors for heart disease that might be different in American Indian communities than have been found in other subpopulations around the world. And then now, since the study's been going on for 30 years, and we have tried to partner with the communities all along, one of the things they have asked is that we move into more interventions, especially interventions in the youth. Many times we'll talk to elders in the community and they'll say, I'm a lost cause, but we really would like you to try to do something to help our youth become more healthy.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, sort of the intergenerational links within the study, because perhaps the people that you studied 30 years ago, some of them might not be around anymore, but maybe their children or grandchildren are now involved in the study. Is that one of the main things that you're looking into in the study to see perhaps how the risks for heart disease might change within from generation to generation?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because you can do that sort of on a population health level and just look at rates of disease from generation to generation. But there are a number of investigators on the project who want to look at how parental health of a parent when a child was young might impact their health as they get older. So there are some studies looking at both genetic and environmental risk factors in participants who we saw as adults maybe in one of the later phases of the Strong Heart study, but whose parents were also enrolled, look at their childhood exposures and see if we can relate that to some aspects of health in adulthood. And also, we would really like to be able to get an ancillary study and also begin to get another generation of Strong Heart study participants enrolled in the study so we can ask some more sophisticated questions.
Texas Biomed recently received a grant to sort of help extend this study along. And so what's the next step forward in this study?
So the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, or NHLBI, has funded the study for another 6 years, and we're very excited about that. That includes another exam of all surviving participants. And also, it includes some pilot money for the communities to do some pilot projects that they decide that they want to do. And it also includes some money for training Native investigators as well.
So what kind of red tape do the researchers kind of have to go through in order to make agreements with these tribes? Because many Indian tribes are very private. They do not like to share much information with the quote-unquote outside world. So what kind of arrangements did the Strong Heart study make with these tribes in order to have that ongoing partnership?
So I got involved in the study in the year 2000, but in 1988 when it began, the NHLBI and the investigators put a lot of effort into discussing the study with the communities and developing a partnership with the communities, getting some agreements in place and some practices in place that would allow the tribes to have input and say about what the study was investigating and how results were presented. And that's really very important, especially for groups that are small and isolated and may be, you know, seriously affected by negative presentation of results. So at that time, one of the procedures that was developed was any study that was done has to obtain tribal approval before it begins, and any publication that comes out of the study also needs to obtain tribal approval before it can be submitted for publication. And we work very hard to make sure that happens and to get feedback from the community during the process.
And so have you come across any complications in having to work with many tribal leaders? Have many of them said, we don't really want you to, for example, draw blood or take samples to your laboratories? Were there any obstacles that you had to face with any of the tribal leaders?
Yes, we have to be very careful about paying attention to aspects of our work that might seem objectionable to the tribes. One of them is looking at what we call admixture, or how much Indian ancestry various participants have. There are political reasons for that. There are economic reasons for that. also, you know, many communities, they have their origin theories that conflict with what we might think of as their ancestral origins of coming across the Bering Strait or whatever anthropology may have discovered. But we do have to pay attention in our analyses to their genetic ancestry, especially our genetic analyses. So they have been really very generous in saying, well, you can do your analyses and you can correct for what you find with our genetic data, but we don't want you to publish the results of that particular analysis. You know, we have community members who actually run the studies in the various regions, but in my interactions with community members, one of the things I always come away with is their focus on generations ahead. Everything they do, they feel, is going to affect generations ahead. And I think that really gives them an advantage. Maybe we can't change things now, but they really do want to try to put things in place for several generations ahead.
Dr. Shelley Cole is associate professor and co-lead of the Population Health Program at the Texas Biomedical Research Institute. She chairs the Strong Heart Study Steering Committee and directs the Strong Heart Study Genetic Center. The Strong Heart Study is one of the largest and longest-running epidemiological and genetic studies involving Native Americans in the U.S., involving over 7,600 participants over a span of nearly 31 years. When we come back, remembering a champion of San Antonio's cultural heritage.
Thanks to him and many others in the Canary Islands, there's a Plaza de San Antonio in the Canary Islands.
That's next on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The Canary Islands are a small chain of Spanish islands located off the coast of Africa, just west of Morocco. They may be a blip on the map, but the influence they had on San Antonio's history and culture is immense. 55 Canary Islanders were sent by Spain in 1731 by King Felipe V. They founded the original municipality of San Fernando de Béjar, what we know now as San Antonio. Alfonso Chiscano was a native of the Canary Islands. He found his way to San Antonio while furthering his career as a thoracic and cardiac surgeon. What he gave to the San Antonio community went way beyond extending people's lives. He made those lives better with his involvement and immersion in San Antonio culture. Chiscano, known as Chico to his friends, died August 27th at age 81. Today, we welcome Steve Chiscano, a San Antonio attorney and one of Alfonso Chiscano's four children, Mari Tamez, president of the Canary Islands Descendants Association, and Dr. Joaquin Gomez Mira, a native of Madrid, Spain, and a radiation oncologist in San Antonio. Steve Chiscano says his father was always wanting to give back.
He had an incredible life as a physician, but for him, that wasn't enough. For him, he needed to give back from where he came from. He was the picture-perfect immigrant for this country.
Dr. Mira, you worked with him for many years. You also are a native of Spain. Was that how you were able to make the connection with Dr. Chiscano?
Well, that is the connection, the Spain. Obviously, I'm not a Canary Islander, but I'm very proud to know the Canary Islands have been part of Spain for 600 years or something like that. And when I came to San Antonio, it was purely for a necessity to get some kind of examination. And I fell in love with the city. I saw the river, Riverwalk. I didn't know anything about the Canary Island connection. But the Spain connection, I did know that. So that was part of my attraction to come to San Antonio. Came in 1976. And I met Dr. Chiscano almost immediately. I don't know how he found out about me, but we connected very quickly. We were both doctors. Our practice was totally different because, you know, cancer is my specialty. He did something else. So our relation was mostly outside medicine, in the sense that actually, you know, it was to do with La Casa de España, which we have, and the many things we did together. Mainly him. He was the driver. He was the one with the ideas, with the drive, and I was happy to help as much as possible. And that gave us a very close connection for many, many years.
Dr. Chiscano, I mean, you've all have given sort of a very short synopsis of his life, but just the work that he did in San Antonio. It's so notable. He was involved in the San Pedro Creek Improvement Project, which is still ongoing. He was able to get the King and Queen of Spain to visit. He was key in that visit for the tricentennial commemorations last year. Does anybody want to talk about how he was able to get the King and Queen of Spain to San Antonio?
I was involved. It's a long story, but to make it very short, I have the opportunity to get an audience, not with the King, but with the Casa Real in Madrid, because I was born in Madrid and knew somebody from there. And initially I said, well, Dr. Mira, we don't need any more help. We have all the help. And I talked to Chico, say, Joaquin, we need to do that. We need to do that, typical him. And he advised me to, and we did it together. And we were together to visit these people. And I think it was very important because this was face-to-face, and this was our interest in bringing the King. And I think that I don't take any credit or little credit, but really it was very important to have Chiscano and myself there and push everybody to do it. And it was a great thing. You know, our Philip the VI, which is the King today, he has the same name as Philip the V, which was the one that actually gave the missions to San Antonio.
Well, there was a beautiful sculpture that was revealed, I think it was last year. It was in La Plaza de las Islas, which is named after the Canary Islands, or in tribute to the Canary Islands. And it's in front of the Bexar County Courthouse here near downtown. I don't know if, Mari, you want to tell us a little bit about that particular sculpture, because it pays tribute to the founders of San Antonio.
So it is named Plaza de las Islas Canarias because it was originally called that. And it was Plaza de las Islas for more than 150 years. It wasn't until the late 1880s that they named it Main Plaza. But for many, many years, it was rightly known as Plaza de las Islas. And for the Tricentennial Commission, the City of San Antonio and Bexar County embraced that idea of reminding people that it was called Plaza de las Islas Canarias so that people would have a better understanding, because there's a lot of areas in downtown San Antonio that were named something else, and then shortly thereafter, the Battle of the Alamo, things were changed. And so it was a nice opportunity to just recognize that. There was nothing that commemorated that Spanish colonial period. Dr. Chiscano, myself, and several others embarked on a mission to try and tell that story. He loved to wear his traje de mago, which is the traditional attire. He would always get so upset because sometimes it's a heavy outfit, okay? It's not built for humidity and heat. And he would say, you need to wear your traje de mago more often, you know. I told him, it's not fair. You look dapper in yours. I'm just sort of dragging around in my attire. But he was very proud and very excited to celebrate his heritage and to embrace the story here. And to ask folks to really pause and look at it for the true beginnings, and that would include the story of the Canary Islanders.
So I'm wondering, Steve, if there's any words you want to say that you think you might want listeners to know about your father.
Well, his gift was not only giving back to San Antonio, but he was giving back to Spain at the same time.
How so?
As much as he was educating us of our history, he was reminding them, hey, guess what? In 1731, you were here, and you've got a San Fernando Cathedral that you gave to us. So don't forget San Antonio. So as much as we're being educated, he had a whole parallel universe happening in Spain in the Canary Islands that, thanks to him and many others in the Canary Islands, there's a Plaza de San Antonio in the Canary Islands to remind the next generation, hey, make the phone call, connect with the little Chiscanos, make sure that this relationship, this bridge that many people built on the Canary Island side, on the Spain side, on the San Antonio side, keep the bridge wide open and keep on trucking, is what he would say.
Well, Dr. Mira, do you have any final words about your friend?
Well, he was a very unusual man in the good sense, to be in the right place at the right time. He chose well. I always say he was a loving person. You know, he didn't want fame for himself and for the things he was doing. And if I would say, this is Dr. No, it's not Dr. Chiscano. There are many more people beside me. We have a Casa España. He was always very loyal to that. And really, it was a real friendship, real love. We enjoy going out together and having some dinners together and discuss all kinds of things. He will call me anytime. How are you doing, Joaquin? How are you? Which is not normal. People say, well, wait a minute, we have to discuss that. No, first, how you are doing. So he was a very, very humble person and a very nice, well-brought-up person, a very loving person.
Mari, what kind of legacy did Dr. Chiscano leave behind?
Actually, he left a beautiful legacy, first and foremost with his family. I was blessed to have a friendship with him, but he always, always took the time to talk about his kids, his love for the islands. We have been a benefit, the association, by his desire to maintain that relationship with the Canary Islands. And I think for our association, the relationship that he's built between our association and the islands is something we will never be able to repay him for, because we did not have that, right? We were proud association about our ancestors' story, but we didn't have that connector, and he bridged that for us.
We've been speaking with Mari Tamez, president of the Canary Islands Descendants Association, Dr. Joaquin Gomez Mira, a native of Madrid, Spain, and a radiation oncologist in San Antonio, and Steve Chiscano, a San Antonio attorney and one of Alfonso Chiscano's four children. Alfonso Chico Chiscano died August 27th at age 81. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Brie Kirkham. And our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.